Chapter 15. The hard-eyed, middle-aged, and utterly professional NP man said to Maury Frauenzimmer and Chick Strikerock,
"You're both under arrest. Come along with me."
"You see," Maury said with scolding accusation to Chick, "I told you so. The bastards have it in for us. We're the fall guys in this. The lowest dupes on the ladder, the ultimate simps."
With Maury, Chick left the small, familiar, cluttered office of Frauenzimmer Associates, the NP man immediately behind them. He and Maury trudged gloomily, in silence, to the parked police car.
"A couple of hours ago," Maury burst out suddenly, "we had everything. Now, on account of your brother, look what we've got. Nothing."
Chick did not respond. There was no answer he could make.
"I'm going to get you, Chick," Maury said,
as the police car started up and moved toward the Autobahn.
"So help me God."
"We'll get out of this," Chick said. "We've had troubles before. They've always passed, somehow."
"If only you had emigrated," Maury said.
"And I wish I had, too," Chick thought to himself. "Right now, Richard Kondroshin and I would be... where? In deep space, on our way to our frontier farm, beginning a chaste new life. And instead, this." He wondered where Kondroshin was right now. Doing just as badly? Hardly likely.
"Next time, when you start to leave the firm," Maury began.
"Okay,"
Chick said savagely.
"Let's forget it. What can be done now?"
"The one I'd like to get," he thought, "is my brother Vince, and after him, Anton and old Felix Karp." The NP man seated next to him all at once said to the NP man driving,
"Hey, look, Sid, a roadblock."
The police car slowed. Peering, Chick saw, at the roadblock, an Army mobile weapons carrier. On it, a big gun pointed eerily at the lines of cars and wheels halted by the barricade across the eight lanes. Beside Chick, the NP man drew his hand weapon. So did the driver.
"What's going on?"
Chick asked, his heart laboring. Neither NP man answered. Their gaze was riveted on the Army unit blocking the Autobahn in effective, trained fashion. Both men had become acutely tense. Chick could sense it. It permeated the interior of the car. At that moment, as the police car crept along, almost touching the car ahead, a Theodorus Nitz commercial slipped in through the open window.
"Do people seem able to see right through your clothing?"
it squeaked at them, bat-like, as it slithered into concealment under the front seat.
"In public, does your fly seem to be unzipped, and do you need to glance down?"
It died into silence as the NP man driving venomously shot it with his pistol.
"Jeez, I hate those things," he spat out with aversion.
At the sound of the shot, the police car was immediately surrounded by soldiers, all armed and all hair trigger alert.
"Put your weapons down,"
the sergeant in charge barked. Reluctantly, the two NP men tossed their guns aside. A soldier plucked the car door open. The two NP men stepped warily out, their arms raised.
"Whom are you shooting at?"
the sergeant demanded.
"At us?"
A Nitz commercial," one of the MP men said shakily.
"Look in the car, under the seat. We weren't shooting at you, honest."
"He's telling the truth,"
a soldier said finally after poking about in the car.
"There is a dead Theodorus Nitz commercial under the seat."
The sergeant reflected and then decided.
"You can go on, but leave your weapons with us," he added, "and your prisoners. And from now on, you take all your orders from GHQ. Not from the higher police."
At once, the two NP men hopped back into their car. The doors slammed shut as they drove off into traffic as rapidly as possible, through the opening in the Army barricade. Chick and Maury watched them go.
"What's up?"
Chick asked.
"You're free to go," the sergeant informed them. "Return to your homes and stay inside. Don't participate in anything going on in the streets, no matter what seems to be happening."
The squad of soldiers moved off then, leaving Chick and Maury standing alone.
"It's a revolt," Maury said, his jaw hanging. "By the army."
"Or by the police," Chick said, thinking rapidly. "We're going to have to hitchhike back to town." He hadn't hitchhiked since he was a kid. It seemed odd to be doing it now in his adult years. It was almost refreshing. He began to walk down the stalled lines of traffic, his thumb out. Wind blew in his face. It smelled of land and water and big cities. He took a deep, full breath of it.
"Wait for me!"
Maury yelled and hurried after him. In the sky, to the north, an immense gray mushroom-like cloud all at once formed, and a rumble stirred through the earth, jarring Chick and making him jump. Shielding his eyes, he peered to see what had happened. An explosion, perhaps a small tactical A-bomb. Now he inhaled the reek of ashes and knew definitely what it was. A soldier, striding past him, said over his shoulder, "The local branch of Karpen Sonnenwerke." He grinned starkly at Chick and hurried on. Maury said in a soft voice, "They blew it up. The army blew up Karp."
"I guess so," Chick said, dazed.
Again, reflexively, he stuck out his thumb, searching for their ride. Above, two army rockets streaked in pursuit of an NP ship. Chick watched them until they were gone from sight. "It's a full-scale war," he said to himself, awed.
"I wonder if they're going to blow us up, too," Maury said. "I mean, the factory. Franz Zimmer Associates."
"We're too small," Chick said.
"Yeah, I guess you're right," Maury said, nodding hopefully.
"It's good to be small," Chick realized, "in times like this. And the smaller the better, right down to the vanishing point."
Ahead of him and Maury, a car had stopped. They walked toward it. Now, to the east, another fungus-shaped mass of cloud material expanded to fill the sky, and again the ground shook. That would be A.G. Camus, Chick decided as he got into the waiting car.
"Where are you boys headed for?"
the driver of the car, a plump, red-haired man, inquired. Maury said,
"Anywhere and everywhere, mister, just so it's away from all this trouble."
"I agree,"
the plump, red-haired man said, and started the car into motion.
"Oh, how I agree."
It was an old, out-of-style car, but it was good enough. Chick Strikerock sat back and made himself comfortable. Beside him, visibly relieved, Maury Frauenzimmer did the same.
"I guess they're getting them big cartels," the red-headed man said,
as he drove slowly forward, following the car ahead of him through the barricade's narrow aperture and out the far side.
"Sure are," Maury said.
"About time," the red-headed man said.
"Right," Chick Strikerock said. "I'm with you there."
The car, gathering speed, moved on. In the large old wooden building, full of dust and echoes, the Chuppers moved about, talking with one another, drinking Cokes, and a few of them were dancing. It was the dancing which interested Nat Flieger, and he led the portable Ampec FA-2 in that direction.
"Dancing, no," Jim Plank said to him. "Singing, yes. Wait until they begin to sing again, if you can dignify it by calling it that."
Nat said, "The sounds of their dancing are rhythmic. I think we ought to try to pick that up, too."
"Technically, you're ahead of this venture," Jim admitted. "But I've done an awful lot of recording in my time, and I say this is useless. It'll be there on the tape, admittedly, or rather in that wormy of yours, but it'll sound like nothing, nothing at all."
He glared remorselessly at Nat.
"But I intend to try anyhow," Nat said to himself. "They're so bent," Molly said, standing beside him. "All of them. And they're so short. Most of them aren't even as tall as I am."
"They lost," Jim said with a laconic shrug. "Remember? What was it, 200,000 years ago? 300,000? Anyhow, it was quite a while ago.
I doubt if they'll survive very much longer this time either. They just don't look like they have it. They look burdened.
That was it, Nat realized. The Chuppers, the Neanderthals, looked weighed down, and by an impossible task, that of survival itself. Jim was absolutely correct. They just were not equipped for that task. Meek, small and hunched, apologetic, shuffling and mumbling, they lurched along their meager life track, getting nearer each moment to the end. So we'd better record this while we can, Nat decided, because it probably won't be long now, from the looks of it. Or could I be wrong? A Chupper, an adult male wearing a plaid shirt and light gray work pants, bumped against Nat and muttered an inarticulate apology.
Well, that's okay, Nat assured him.
He felt then the desire to test his theory, to try to cheer up this failing life form, this throwback.
Let me buy you a beer, he said to the Chupper. Okay?
There was, he knew, a bar of sorts in the rear of the building, this large central recreation hall which the Chuppers seemed to possess collectively. The Chupper, glancing at him shyly, mumbled a no thanks.
Why not? Nat demanded.
'Cause. The Chupper seemed unable to meet Nat's gaze. He regarded the floor, clenched and unclenched his fists in a closed circuit-like but passing spasm.
I can't,
the Chupper finally managed to say. However, he did not go. He remained standing in front of Nat, still staring down and still grimacing. Probably he was frightened, Nat decided, embarrassed in a frightened, obliterating way. To the Chupper, Jim Plank said drawlingly,
Hey, can you sing any good Chupper songs? We'll record you.
He winked at Nat.
Leave him alone, Molly said. You can see he can't sing. He can't do anything, that's obvious.
She walked away, clearly angry at both of them. The Chupper glanced after her listlessly, drooping in his Chupper fashion. His eyes were dull.
Would anything, Nat wondered, make those dull eyes light up? Why did the Chuppers want to survive if life meant so little to them?
He thought suddenly, maybe they're waiting for something that hasn't happened yet, but which they know or hope will occur. That would explain their manner, their emptiness.
Leave him alone, Nat said to Jim Plank.
She's right. He put his hand on Jim's shoulder, but the recording expert pulled away.
I think they can do a lot more than they appear to be able to, Jim said. It's almost as if they're marking time, not expending themselves, not trying. Hell, I'd like to see them try.
So would I, Nat said, but we're not going to be able to get them to try. Off in a corner of the hall, a television set boomed loudly, and a number of Chuppers, both male and female, had wandered over to it to stand inertly in front of it. The TV set, Nat realized, was giving news of some urgent sort. At once he turned his attention that way. Something had happened.
You hear what the newscaster is saying? Jim said in his ear. My God, some damn thing about a war.
The two of them edged through the throng of Chuppers, shoving their way up to the TV set. Molly was already there, already absorbed in listening.
It's a revolution, she said stonily to Nat above the hollow, booming uproar emanating from the TV set's audio system.
Carp? Her face was drenched with disbelief. The Carps and A.G. Kemi, they tried to seize power, along with the National Police. The TV screen showed a smoking, virtually disintegrated ruin, the remains of buildings, an industrial installation of great magnitude that had been all but obliterated. It was, to Nat, unrecognizable.
That's Carp's Detroit branch, Molly managed to tell Nat above the racket. The military got it. Honest to God, that's what the announcer just said.
Jim Plank, studying the screen impassively, said,
Who's winning?
Nobody yet, Molly said. Evidently. I don't know. Listen and see what he says. It's just broken out, just getting underway.
The choppers, listening and watching, had become silent. The phonograph, which had played background music for them to shuffle to, had become silent too. The choppers, almost all of them now, stood clustered around the TV set, rapt and attentive, as they witnessed the scenes of fighting between the armed forces of the USEA and the issue from the barracks of the National Police backed up by the cartel system.
In California, the announcer was spluttering, the West Coast Division of the NP surrendered intact to the 6th Army under General Hoheit. However, in Nevada,
the set showed a street scene, downtown Reno. An army barricade had been hastily erected, and police snipers were firing at it from the windows of the nearby buildings.
Ultimately, the newscaster said, the fact that the armed forces possess a virtual monopoly in atomic weapons would seem to guarantee them victory. But for the present, we can only...
The newscaster rattled excitedly on, as all over the USEA, the mechanical reporting machines coasted about in the areas of conflict, gathering data for him.
It's going to be a long fight, Jim Plank said suddenly to Nat. He looked gray and tired.
I guess we're darn lucky we're here.
Out of the way, he murmured, half to himself. It's a good time to lay low.
The screen showed a clash between a police patrol and an army unit now. The two fired rapidly at each other, scurrying for cover as shots zinged from their automatic small arms. A soldier pitched forward on his face, and then so did a gray NP man. Next to Nat Flieger, a chopper, watching absorbedly, nudged the chopper standing beside him. The two choppers, both males, smiled at each other. A covert, meaningful smile. Nat saw it, saw the expression on their two faces, and then he realized that all the choppers had become bright-eyed with the same secret pleasure.
What's going on here? Nat wondered.
Beside him, Jim Plank said softly,
Nat, my God, they've been waiting for this.
So this is it, Nat realized with a thrill of fear. The emptiness, the dull listlessness, that had gone. The choppers were alert now as they viewed the flickering TV image and listened to the excited news announcer.
What does this mean to them? Nat wondered as he studied their emotion-laden, eager faces. It means, he decided, that they have a chance. This might be their opportunity. We're destroying each other before their eyes, and it may provide room for them, a space to squeeze into. Room, not cooped up here in this dreary, tiny enclave, but out in the world itself. Everywhere.
Grinning knowingly at one another, the choppers continued avidly to watch and listen. Nat's fear grew. The plump, red-headed man who had given Maury and Chick the ride said,
Well, this is as far as I'm going, boys. You'll have to hop out.
He slowed the car, stopped at the curb. They were in the city now, off the Autobahn. On every side, men and women scampered in panic, seeking shelter. A police car, its windshield shattered, nosed forward cautiously, the men inside bristling with weapons.
Better get indoors, the red-headed man advised.
Warily, Chick and Maury emerged from the car.
My place, the Abraham Lincoln, Chick said, is near here. We can walk it. Come on.
He waved big, overweight Maury ahead, and the two of them joined the running mob of frightened, confused people.
What a mess, Chick said to himself. I wonder how it'll wind up. I wonder if our society, our style of life, will survive this.
I feel sick in my stomach, Maury groaned, puffing along beside him, his face gray from the exertion. I'm not used to this.
They reached the Abraham Lincoln. It was undamaged. At the doorway, their sergeant of arms, with a gun, stood beside Vince Strikerock, their identification reader. Vince was checking each person in turn, busy at his official task.
"Hi, Vince," Chick said when he and Maury arrived at the station.
His brother jerked, raised his head. They regarded each other in silence. At last, Vince said,
"Hi, Chick. Glad to see you're alive." "Do we get in?" Chick said.
"Sure," Vince said. He looked away, then, nodding to the sergeant of arms, he said to Chick,
"Go ahead. I'm sure glad the MP didn't manage to corner you."
He did not look once at Maury Frauenzimmer. He pretended that Maury was not there.
"What about me?"
Maury said. In a strangled voice, Vince said,
"You can go inside, too, as Chick's special invited guest."
Behind them, the next man in line said with urgent peevishness,
"Hey, hurry up, will you? It isn't safe out here."
He bumped Chick, nudging him on. Quickly, Chick and Maury passed on inside the Abraham Lincoln. A moment later, they were ascending by a familiar means, a building elevator, to Chick's top-floor apartment.
"I wonder what he got out of it," Maury said musingly.
"Your kid brother, I mean."
"Nothing," Chick said shortly. "Carp is gone. He and a lot of people are finished now."
"And Vince isn't the only one I know of that group," he said to himself.
"Including us," Maury said. "We're no better off. Of course, I guess a lot depends on who wins."
"It doesn't matter who wins," Chick said.
Not as far as he could make out, at least. The destruction, the great national disaster, was still there. That was the terrible thing about Civil War. No matter how it came out, it was still bad. Still a catastrophe. And for everyone. When they reached the apartment, they found the door unlocked. With massive caution, Chick opened the door and peeped inside. There stood Julie.
"Chick,"
she said, starting a step or so toward him. Beside her were two big suitcases.
"I've been packing. I've made arrangements for you and me to emigrate. I've got the tickets. And don't ask me how, because I'll never tell you."
Her face was pale but composed. She had dressed up quite a bit and looked, he thought, exceptionally fine. Now she saw Maury.
"Who is this?"
she asked, faltering.
"My boss," Chick said. "I just have two tickets," Julie said hesitantly.
"That's okay," Maury said to her.
He beamed at her to reassure her.
"I have to stay on Earth. I've got a major business enterprise to preside over."
To Chick, he said,
"I think she's got a good idea. So, this is the girl you told me about on the phone. The reason you were late to work that morning."
He slapped Chick genially on the back.
"Lots of luck to you, old buddy. I guess you've proved you're still young. Young enough, anyhow. I envy you."
Julie said, "Our ship leaves in 45 minutes. I was praying like hell you'd show up here. I tried to get hold of you at work."
"The NP picked us up," Chick told her.
"The Army has control of the space field," Julie said, "and they're supervising the arrivals and departures of deep space ships. So if we can just make it to the field, we'll be all right." She added, "I put all your money and mine together to buy the tickets. They were incredibly expensive. And with those jalopy jungles gone..."
"You two guys better get started," Maury said. "I'll stay here in the apartment, if it's okay with you. It appears to be reasonably safe here, all things considered."
He seated his weary, overstuffed body on the couch, managed to cross his legs, got out a Dutch Master cigar, and lit up.
"Maybe I'll see you again one of these days," Chick said to him awkwardly.
He did not know exactly how to make the break to leave.
"Maybe so," Maury grunted. "Anyhow, drop me a line from Mars."
He picked up a magazine from the coffee table and leafed through it, his attention turned to it.
"What are we going to do on Mars to stay alive?" Chick asked Julie.
"Farm? Or had you thought about that?"
"Farm. claim a piece of good land and get started irrigating it. I have relatives there. They'll help us get started.
She picked up one of the suitcases. Chick took it away from her and then hoisted the other.
So long, Maury said in a contrived, overly light tone. I wish you two luck scratching around in that red dusty soil.
Good luck to you too, Chick said. I wonder who'll need it the most, he wondered. You here on Earth or us on Mars?
Maybe I'll send you a couple of Sims, Maury said, to keep you company when this all blows over.
Puffing on his cigar, he watched the two of them go. The blaring music had arrived once more now, and some of the hunched, massive-jawed chuppers had resumed their shuffling dancing. Nat Flieger turned away from the TV set.
I think we've got enough on the Ampac, he said to Molly. We can start back to the Kondrosian's house. We're through. Finally.
Molly said somberly,
Maybe we're through everywhere, Nat. You know, just because we've been the dominant species for a few tens of thousands of years, it doesn't ensure that...
I know, Nat said to her. I saw their faces, too. He led her back to where they had left the Ampec FA-2. Jim Plank followed, and the three of them stood together by the portable recording apparatus.
Well, Nat said, shall we start back? Is it really over?
It's over, Jim Plank said, nodding. But I think, Molly said, we should stay here in the Jenner area until the fighting lets up. It wouldn't be safe to try to fly back down below to Tijuana right now. If Beth Kondrosian will let us stay, let's stay right there in the house.
All right, Nat said. He agreed with her completely.
Jim Plank said abruptly, Look, there's a woman coming over here toward us. Not a chopper, but a, you know, what we are. The same as us.
The woman, slender and young, with short cropped hair, wearing blue cotton trousers and moccasins and a white shirt, threaded her way through the shuffling gangs of choppers.
I know her, Nat said to himself. I've seen her a million times. He knew her, and yet he did not. It was terribly strange. So incredibly damn pretty, he thought. Almost grotesquely, unnaturally beautiful. How many women that attractive do I know? None. No one in our world, in our lives, is that attractive except Nicole Thibodeau.
Are you Mr. Flieger? She called, coming up close to him, then gazing up into his face. She was very small, he discovered. That had not been apparent over the TV transmissions. In fact, he had always thought of Nicole Thibodeau as looming large, even ominous. It was a distinct shock to find her otherwise. He could not exactly understand it.
Yes, he said.
Nicole said,
Richard Kondrosian put me here, and I want to get back where I belong. Can you take me out of here in your auto cab?
Sure, Nat said, nodding. Anything.
None of the choppers paid any attention to her. They seemed neither to know nor care who she was. Jim Plank and Molly, however, gaped in mute, awed disbelief.
When are you leaving? Nicole asked.
Well, Nat said, we were going to stay. Because of the fighting, it seemed safer here.
No,
Nicole insisted at once.
You have to go back. You have to do your part. Do you want them to win?
I don't even know who you're talking about, Nat said. I can't make out exactly what's going on, what the issues are, or who's fighting whom. Do you know? Maybe you can tell me.
But I doubt it, he thought. I doubt if you can turn it into something sensible for me or for anyone else, because it is just not sensible. Nicole said,
What would it require to get you to take me back, or at least out of here?
Shrugging, Nat said, Nothing. All at once he had made up his mind. He saw things clearly. Because I won't do it.
I'm sorry, we're going to wait this out, this event that's going on. I don't know how Kondroshin managed to put you here, but maybe he's right. Maybe this is the best place to be, for you and for us, for a long time to come. He smiled at her. Nicole did not smile back.
Damn you, Nicole said.
He continued to smile.
Please, she said. Help me. You were going to. You started to.
Speaking up huskily, Jim Plank said,
Maybe he is helping you, Mrs. Thibodeau, by doing this, by keeping you here.
I think Nat's right, too, Molly said. I'm sure it's unsafe for you at the White House right now.
Nicole looked around fiercely at the three of them. Then, resignedly, she sighed.
Oh, what a place to be stuck in. Damn that Richard Kondroshin, too. It's basically his fault. What are these creatures?
She gestured at the shuffling line of adult choppers and the small neo-chopper children who lined both sides of the great dusty wooden hall.
I'm not quite certain, Nat said.
Relatives of ours, you could say.
Progeny, very possibly.
Forefathers,
Jim Plank said, correcting him. Nat said, Time will tell which it is. Lighting a cigarillo, Nicole said vigorously,
I don't like them. I'll feel a lot happier when we get back to the house. They make me just dreadfully uncomfortable.
They should, Nat said. Certainly, he shared her extreme reaction. Around the four of them, the choppers danced their monotonous dance, paying no attention to the four human beings.
I think, however, Jim Plank said thoughtfully, we're going to have to get accustomed to them.
We hope you have enjoyed our presentation of The Simulacra by Philip K. Dick. Copyright 1964 by Philip K. Dick. Copyright renewed 1992 by Laura Coelho, Christopher Dick, and Isa Hackett. Performed by Dick Hill, directed by Susie Breck. Performance copyright 2011 by Brilliance Audio. All rights reserved. For further information concerning this program or other Brilliance Audio titles, please call the following toll-free number, 1-800-222-3225, or visit our website at www.brillianceaudio.com. No part of this recording may be played for an audience or reproduced in any form. It may not be streamed, downloaded, broadcast, or copied without written permission. Address all inquiries to Brilliance Audio, Post Office Box 887, Grand Haven, Michigan, 49417.